Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Feldstein, author of The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Shaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The world is undergoing a profound set of digital disruptions that are changing the nature of how governments counter dissent and assert control over their countries. While increasing numbers of people rely primarily or exclusively on online platforms, authoritarian regimes have concurrently developed a formidable array of technological capabilities to constrain and repress their citizens. In his book, The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Shaping Power, Politics, and Resistance, Stephen Feldstein documents how the emergence of advanced digital tools bring new dimensions to political repression. Presenting new field research from Thailand, the Philippines, and Ethiopia, he investigates the goals, motivations, and drivers of these digital tactics. Stephen Feldstein is a senior fellow in Carnegie's Democracy, Conflict, and Governance program. Prior to that, Boise State was fortunate enough to have Steve serve as the Frank Church Chair of Public Affairs at the Frank Church Institute at Boise State. His articles and essays have appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Washington Post, among other places. Steve Feldstein, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to have you here in Boise in a very different venue, a digital venue compared to when you were here on campus and did so many good things for us. Perhaps before we get into the book, you could give us some idea, aside from writing the book, what are your duties at in the Carnegie program?
Yeah, well, you know, Carnegie Endowment is a think tank, and so in that sense, it operates sort of similarly to a university, except that there are no classes or teaching responsibilities. But right. Among the research I'm looking at are a pretty wide range of things. So certainly building on the topic of the book, looking at how technology, politics, and democracy are playing out. But I'm also looking at broader U.S. foreign policy issues and other issues related to human rights and how the Biden administration in particular will sort of shape a new direction when it comes to U.S. engagement in the world.
Well, you certainly have your hands full with what's going on in Afghanistan these days. This is not a program to talk about that. We're going to dive right into digital repression here. But it's great to see you doing so well and being so successful in Washington. Have you ever thought about going back to government? You were in government before you came out here.
Well, you know, there's always a temptation, and it's hard to predict the future. So we'll see. But I'm certainly working very closely with a lot of members of the Biden team right now, which is a really nice thing. A lot of friends have gone back in. And so we have pretty good lines of communication on some of these important issues that you already mentioned.
Yeah, great. Well, we certainly need them now more than ever. So let's start from the beginning. Digital repression. You identify five broad areas of digital repression. Why don't you start there?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I tried to do when I approached this topic is it really felt immense, and there were so many different technologies and techniques out there. And so I wanted to kind of break it down a little more systematically into different categories. And so I've identified sort of five broad areas where digital repression kind of works. One is surveillance techniques, and that's everything from the kind of mass surveillance you'd see in China to more targeted spyware that countries like Saudi Arabia use. Second is censorship. Again, that can also be kind of broad, like the Great Firewall that China has, but also could be specific blocking of websites or taking down of social media. Third is disinformation. And so we think of disinformation often as something that lies outside the province of governments. But around the world, many political leaders are weaponizing social media and using disinformation as a tool of rule. Fourth, you have internet shutdowns where you break connectivity when you have protests, for example. And then finally, there's the systematic targeting of online users, especially people who have large followings, and you know, persecuting, putting them in jail. People like Alexei Navalny is a good example of that.
So, just a curious point here: how did the Saudis use spyware to surveil their citizens?
Yeah, well, you know, there was a big Washington Post investigation, in fact, that just came about a couple weeks ago, and what they were found to have done is that they work with an Israeli spyware company called NSO Group. And so they get this program, the software, and they're able to install remotely the software on different targets' phones or computers. And so then they're able to read all the emails, all the messaging, that these different targets are doing. They can do location tracking and monitoring. Essentially, they have insight into every single thing their targets are saying, who they're communicating with, what they're doing on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis.
So what are the three groups of actors that make up the digital ecosystem?
Yeah, well, you have governments, of course. And so states are really kind of using these techniques for their own kind of gain in terms of really trying to accomplish their political objectives. And this is oftentimes something you'll see in authoritarian countries, but even a lot of weaker democracies like India are also using these techniques. You certainly have civil society and citizens, right? They are those who are oftentimes the ones who are targeted, you know, by these different techniques, the ones who use digital means to organize, to mobilize protests against regimes that they feel are repressive. And then you also have the, you know, of course, the private sector companies, the firms, the ones who manufacture these devices or the ones who run platforms, you know, the ones who both provide some of the kind of most malevolent spyware and other types of techniques, but also the ones who are keeping open channels of communication, like those who run, you know, forums like Telegram. So those are sort of broadly speaking, kind of three stakeholders who are kind of key aspects to understanding how this ecosystem works.
Well, let's just take the first two governments, repressive governments, and then the second one, the dissenters, civil society, the dissenters in civil society that are trying to take on these regimes. If this were a baseball game in the seventh inning, who's ahead?
Well, you know, it's interesting. 10 years ago, the answer would have been, this is, I guess, probably more like first or second inning. We would have said that the dissenters were really doing a pretty great job of putting governments on their back foot. They even kind of called technology liberation technology because they were able to use social media, Facebook, Twitter, and other sort of means to mobilize citizens in a way that hadn't been seen to push back against governments. And that's why you saw with the Arab Spring and the color revolutions, different longstanding dictatorships fall. But what has happened subsequently in the last 10 years is that governments saw what happened and they got smart. They said, wait a second, we're not just going to sit back and allow you know, protesters or our opponents to organize in Facebook and not do anything. And so they started finding ways to try to cut off access to these platforms, or even better, to also use these platforms, but to manipulate the information on them so that citizens weren't able to tell what was true and what wasn't, to essentially poison the information well. And so now we're at a point where governments have done a really good job of learning from their past mistakes and being able to apply those lessons in ways that you know, are bringing newfound levels of repression. So I would say at this juncture, and I think some of this is cyclical though, but I would say at this moment, states have really put civil society and others on their back foot, and that it's a challenging environment when it comes to kind of pushing back against these authoritarian regimes in particular.
Now, when it comes to the technologies these countries are using, I never really gave much thought until I read your book to whether or not the technology is homegrown or whether the technology is coming from someplace like China or Russia. Well, let's talk about China. Why don't you share with us, not all these countries have the technological capability to produce this stuff, but I guess they know where to get it.
That's right. I mean, in some ways, you can sort of think of it like the kind of arms industry, right? I mean, certain types of technologies you can find and you can cultivate domestically. But when you look to more sophisticated means, let's say surveillance cameras or facial recognition, right? These are things that you really need to access high-level advanced equipment and operators who know how to use this well. So if you're a country that doesn't really have much of this on the shelf, let's say Ethiopia, you know, what do you do? Well, you turn to different vendors and firms who are backed by governments from around the world in order to get an ICT network put in place in order to access surveillance equipment that can be used to target particular individuals who represent threats to regimes. And so, you know, one of the big questions that a lot of people are trying to figure out is that, is there a pattern in terms of who's providing this technology? Is it just China? Is it just Russia? Or is it also democracies as well? And, you know, one of the insights I found in the book after talking to lots of different stakeholders and researching the issue is that, you know, it's really a pretty diverse landscape in that when you go to a country that is looking to get more advanced equipment for repression, they oftentimes will source from the United States, from U.S. companies, from Israeli companies, from European companies, as much as they will also look to your more classic authoritarians in order to get this type of equipment, like your China's and Russia's.
You're listening to Stephen Feldstein. He's the author of The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. So how do they source from the United States, the companies in the United States? It just seems to me a logical conclusion could be drawn that this isn't allowed. We don't allow companies to send digital repression technology elsewhere. I assume there must be some kind of a cover for whatever they're giving these countries that gets them past whatever laws there are or aren't there laws.
Right. Well, I mean, so one answer to that is that there isn't much in the way of law that sort of prohibits the selling of what they call dual-use technology. So a lot of the technology that's given has a legally justified purpose. It happens just to be abused and violated in certain ways. So take, you know, something like surveillance. I mean, there are genuine public order and national security rationales for why countries like Kenya would want to have a surveillance system in their capital city to ward off terrorists and other insurgent groups, right? So fair enough. What the problem is that it's not just used for that purpose. It's also used to look into and crack down on opponents, legitimate dissenters, civic activists, and so forth. And so when it comes to these dual use technologies, unlike, you know, regulating the sale of arms, right, there just isn't the same kind of policy framework in place to say, this is likely to be abused, so therefore, no, this one's okay. You don't have the same kind of licensing framework yet. Now, some people want to push for that, and I think over time that will probably go into place. But right now, it's pretty wide open.
Anybody in Congress taking the lead on this?
Yeah, there are some. There's certainly been some hearings, and there's certain congressmen. My old boss, Tom Malinowski, for example, has been pretty outspoken in terms of kind of pushing for, you know, a greater coherence when it comes to what's allowed and what shouldn't be, especially when it comes to the sort of spyware programming that I mentioned. So there is a growing momentum, I think, to think very carefully about how these tools are used and who should have access to them. But it's still slow going, and I think it'll take some time.
Well, you did quite a bit of traveling to put this book together, Thailand, the Philippines, and also Ethiopia. I wonder if we could start with Thailand. I think you shared with your readers in the book that Thailand was in many ways ripe for digital repression, given the certain conditions that were there. Could you share those with us?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Thailand, when I was there, was in the midst of a junta that had taken over a few years prior, and they were had just held elections to try to reinstall a, quote, democratic government. But really, it was a handpicked regime that was similar to the, you know, military folks who are running things. And so, you know, it's a country that kind of has an interesting contradiction. It has a very classically authoritarian political landscape, you know, with a monarchy and military establishment that keeps a close lid on who actually runs the country. On the other hand, it also is a very dynamic place with a booming economy, a well-educated cohort of younger people, and a growing, I think, level of angst about where the country is headed and why people can't have more of a say and to participate in politics. And so this kind of collective dynamic has made for a combustible environment. And so what you see particularly is that more and more young people, youth, are organizing online, trying to find political parties that they feel represent their interests. And the junta is trying to find ways, the government, to crack down on that. And they're using a variety of methods in which to do so. I mean, a lot of it actually is, frankly, you arrest a few people and you kind of create a chilling effect so that it's sort of seen as a warning about what will happen to you if you challenge the regime. But either way, I mean, it's a situation where you have a pretty well-established authoritarian system that is slowly feeling the strains of people pushing back and saying, wait a second, I want more political freedoms.
So what role does China play in Thailand's digital repression techniques?
So it's interesting. I mean, certainly China has a presence in Thailand, and it has provided a number of different technologies that are used, particularly on the surveillance side. But one of the key insights I found as I kind of talked to a number of different folks, including some pretty senior members of the intelligence community in Thailand, was that there are a lot of other actors who are also providing equipment. And so the Israelis in particular were pointed out as ones who have helped a lot on the cybersecurity censorship front. Others, some U.S. and European companies as well, particularly when it comes to spyware. So to really sort of say it's just a China repression issue, I think really kind of misses what's actually the bigger picture, when in fact, I would say it's driven by domestic politics And the leaders who are in power want to source from a variety of different countries in order to get what they feel is the best combination of technology that can help them accomplish their political objectives.
Give us an example of a U.S. company that's in this sort of business, that if there was a law, they might be severely restricted or limited.
Yeah, I mean, there's a variety of different types of companies. I mean, I think, you know, a few that people sometimes talk about, like Palantir is one, where they work, they have a number of contracts with different security services around the world. And, you know, often there are legally justifiable, legitimate reasons for why they are working with different police forces in different countries. I think, you know, the question is, are these police forces also committing abuses? And who is ultimately responsible for how these products are used? I mean, this is the kind of the crux of the whole problem. There is a number of other companies, you know, Cellebrite, which does spyware. I think it's both Israeli and U.S. Sandvine is actually a really good example. So Sandvine is a U.S.-Canadian company that was found to provide censorship blocking technology to Belarus. And there was a Bloomberg investigation last year that uncovered Sandvine's role. So all of a sudden, you know, there was a big brouhaha. People in Congress started pushing back, and Sandvine quickly withdrew its contracts from Belarus, but not after it already had provided this type of technology to a very authoritarian government for a number of years, including during the actual protests that have recently been ongoing. So that's a pretty good example of kind of an egregious act by a U.S. company.
Sure is. You also visited the Philippines, home to the autocratic President Duterte. Tell us how digital repression works there.
Yeah, and the Philippines was really an interesting study. It's very different than what I saw in Thailand or in other kind of more traditional authoritarian countries, in that it's a, you know, a liberal democracy or a weak democracy that's ruled by a leader who has very autocratic tendencies, Duterte. And so there is, on the one hand, a limit to the type of techniques he can deploy. So he's not going to censor widespread or use mass surveillance against his citizens the way you would see a country like Russia or China do. It's not something that really fits within the political culture or the traditions of the Philippines. And so he has to resort to other means in order to harness and manipulate and accomplish his political goals. And so what he's been able to do instead is really use in a newfound novel way social media in order to both set out and put forth sort of false messages about what he's doing and, you know, how good, how all the different things he's accomplishing in the country, but also as a means and a tool to intimidate, harass, and silence those who would question his different policies. And he's done so then. He then sort of uses social media to tarnish different people, such as the journalist Maria Ressa. And then his police forces pick up and charge her on very flimsy grounds with cyber libel or with defamation or with some other kind of charge. And then she ends up facing jail time. And this is sort of the classic way that Duterte is able to kind of manipulate the information environment as a key part of his political strategy.
I think you defined the amount of disinformation permeating Philippine social media as astronomic proportions. What role does Facebook play in this?
Yeah, no, I was just going to get to that. So, you know, what's particularly interesting is that so much when we look at sort of digital repression, we say, well, what about the surveillance companies linked in China or in other kind of countries? But, you know, in a country like the Philippines, Facebook is the platform and means by which Duterte is using these disinformation strategies to bolster his political rule. And so, you know, what was also particularly interesting is that when he was a presidential candidate, you know, 5 years ago, and running, he wasn't very well known. He didn't have a well-financed campaign operation. And so he had to resort to social media in order to get his name out, to get name recognition. And so it's because of Facebook, many would argue, that he was able to get elected in the first place. And so he saw how powerful a tool Facebook was. And he said, well, you know, not only did it get me elected, but now I'm going to use it as a tool of governing. And so he's done that very well. And so many people sort of say, well, what's the culpability of Facebook? Right. You know, like if you look at a situation like the Philippines and all the repression that's taking place, you know, you can sort of ask, could Facebook do more? Should it be doing more? Is there, you know, is there a linkage and a direct linkage between Facebook providing this platform and then the exploitation, weaponization of it by Duterte and his allies?
What's the answer to that question?
Well, I would say that there's, you know, I think there's certainly, you know, blame to be shared. Without any question. It's a whole other conversation in terms of looking at kind of the culpability of Facebook when it comes to these issues. But what I would say, and what I said in the book, is that you can't turn away and not look at what Facebook has done and say that they don't have dirty hands to some degree in terms of this issue. However, we also have to focus on who are the actual actors who are choosing to propagate disinformation and false narratives and intimidation and harassment. It's Duterte. And so, you know, we can't also just blame a platform without looking at the actual individuals who are making decisions to manipulate and weaponize information for personal gain.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Stephen Feldstein. He's the author of The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. Well, Congress has certainly been focused on Facebook and other social media outlets over the last few years. Is there more that they should be doing as far as what Facebook is allowed to do or can do across the globe?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, frankly, we've really been sort of missing the boat in terms of having any kind of regulatory constraints in terms of how social media companies operate. You know, right now, they have sort of blanket protection in terms of what people say online, and there's no privacy framework in place. There's no way to kind of guard user data. There's really very few bounds when it comes to how algorithms feed and lift up the most extreme information. So somewhere we ought to find a balance. I mean, it's tough because we want to make sure that freedom of expression is something that is absolutely maintained and remains a core part of how political discourse works. At the same time, when the information environment is flooded by disinformation, it doesn't become an area where the marketplace of ideas, as we like to think about it, is able to flourish in any way. So finding a way to cut back on and reinstill more of a kind of public civic forum to how these different platforms work, I think is essential. And we just haven't found a way to get to that yet. But I also don't think we've made much of an effort at all. And so that's, I think, something that's going to really move more to the forefront in Congress and in other and with the Biden administration in the next couple of years.
I mean, the only other way of dealing with this is the user. And it's easy for me to say because I'm not on Facebook, even though I'm on Twitter. But it would seem to me that if users dropped Facebook in substantial numbers, you're sending a message to a company that it's time to do something about this. But again, that's a subject for your next book. Let's talk about Ethiopia. And there again, you've traveled there and you in recent years have seen a record of digital repression. I think China, again, is involved here, but tell us about it.
Yeah, so Ethiopia is a complicated story in a number of respects. I mean, one of the actually interesting things is that, you know, when I was in Ethiopia and I traveled there last year in February, there was actually a time of cautious hope that the Prime Minister Abiy, the one in charge, was actually, you know, putting in place more liberal policies and that we were able to kind of look back at some of the more repressive policies of his predecessors and say, well, we seem to be establishing something better. And that some of the surveillance questions that the prior regime had used, the censorship, the targeting of individuals, you know, online users, that this seemed to be dissipating. Well, unfortunately, what's happened since I traveled there and then subsequent to the publication of this book is that Ethiopia is now descended into civil war. Right. So in that sense, all bets are off in terms of where things will end up in the country. And it's just been shocking to witness just how quickly the country has moved from a somewhat optimistic trajectory to one where no one knows how far the bottom will fall when it comes to the humanitarian crisis and war that's taking place there. So that's just one point I wanted to mention. But, you know, I would also say in Ethiopia, what's interesting is that when I was there, I was starting to see a transition from kind of old repressive styles of digital repression, so the surveillance and censorship, to more of an embrace of disinformation. And, you know, what we've seen, particularly in conjunction with the war effort that's taking place right now, is the heightened use of disinformation to target certain ethnic minority groups, to push a narrative that promotes the current leader Abiy's political agenda at all costs, even when he's been shown to authorize some really egregious human rights violations and some terrible political choices. So, you know, we're in a really sort of shifting terrain when it comes to Ethiopia. And it's hard to say exactly where things will end up. And digital technology is right in the center of that.
And I don't want to give our listeners the impression that just because you traveled to these three countries and included them in your book, that these are the only countries that are utilizing these repressive techniques and the social media designs on their citizens. So I mean, could you give us a rough estimate how many countries across the globe are using digital repression of some kind or another?
Well, yeah, I think it's more a matter of degree than whether a country is or is not using it. Almost every country, to some extent, whether it's limited or more significant, is wielding these techniques. I mean, you could say without any question, any country that's authoritarian, let's say that's about 50% or higher at this point of the world's countries, are using digital repression, period. And then one of the kind of growing cohort of countries that are increasing their use of these techniques are your weaker democracies, your illiberal populist democracies, places like Hungary, right. You know, the Philippines, Nigeria, and so forth. And so what that then leaves you is a much smaller group of liberal democracies where there's, you know, less of an official take up of these techniques, but they are used even in countries like, say, let's look at ourselves, like the United States. You know, even here, we've seen instances where the weaponization of disinformation techniques via social media has been a really prevalent part of our politics. And it'd be hard to sort of disaggregate that from how, you know, our leaders have decided to rule. So it's really everywhere, but it's much more pronounced. It's much more egregious. It's much more serious in countries that are authoritarian. That's an important takeaway.
You mentioned at the outset of this interview that you have three groups of actors. You have the governments that are doing the repressing. You have civil society, the dissenters who are fighting against repressive governments. And then you have the companies. And since we've been talking about Facebook and what more it should be doing or what maybe the government ought to be doing to force Facebook to do more, let's talk about Telegram, which in your book you use as a contrast company that has clear-cut policy or human rights interest in protecting user privacy. Could you share that with us?
Yeah. And so Telegram is interesting. And, you know, there's sort of two ways to think about Telegram. So on the one hand, you know, Telegram and Signal, which is another counterpart that uses encrypted communications so that people are protected from the intrusion of outside actors who want to see what people are communicating or saying. You know, these have been the lifeline for a number of protest movements, whether it's in Belarus, whether it's in Russia or Iran or other sort of closed contexts. So without having these platforms at hand, it would be that much harder for civil society activists, for political opponents and others to be able to organize and talk to one another. So, you know, those have been absolutely essential tools in that regard. However, just as they can help to facilitate what we think of as more beneficial types of communication, they also have been a turn to for groups, whether it's, you know, classic terrorist groups like ISIS, the Islamic State, or, you know, some of your right-wing extremist groups that were responsible for the January 6th insurrection. They have also migrated and turned to encrypted applications in order to organize and stay in touch and plan other sorts of schemes. And so, you know, this sort of shows you the flip side of where some of this can go in that, you know, these are relatively neutral platforms, but how users use them, how they choose to communicate and what they choose to do with that communication, it can vary quite a bit.
Yeah, it's not all saintly behavior, I guess you could say. Well, let's talk a little bit, this is the last question I have time for, but I want you to comment on Chinese and Russian exports of digital repression technology. You suggest a set of policies that really aim at changing the behavior of China and Russian firms as far as the exportation of this technology. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, I think especially when it comes to the infrastructure that's put in place in different countries, that we have to be really, we have to take really seriously the nature of the type of technology that these companies are putting in place, not only because it binds countries more closely to the political orientation of a China or Russia, China, I would say really in particular, you know, but also that it helps to extend their influence, and the type of surveillance or censorship components that are built in are just much more out there, much more explicit. And so rather than just sort of let the market kind of do its magic, which the Chinese never do anyway, they subsidize and they push when it comes to interacting with countries so that they will, you know, these countries will acquire certain technologies. The U.S. and other democracies really have to make a more sustained push to compete in third countries against Chinese technology. 5G communications is a good example of that, where the U.S. has started to work with European partners to present alternatives to countries that are thinking about sourcing from Chinese telecommunications companies versus Western democratic ones. And to the extent that we can, you know, democracies can present more of a choice to these countries. So when in India or a Kenya or a Pakistan is trying to make decisions about where they will source their technology from, I think that's to the benefit of democracies everywhere.
Well, Steve, you've written a great work here, The Rise of Digital Repression, How Technology is Reshaping Power, Politics, and Resistance. It's an important addition to the knowledge we all must have to this profound set of digital disruptions I mentioned in the introduction and the role it's playing in repressing citizens across the globe when it comes to their governments. So I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner, and specifically thank you for writing The Rise of Digital Repression.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bob. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate you taking the time to read the book and share it with your listeners.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. You can also access Reader's Corner at our app. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.